Hello everyone, welcome back. I hope you're excited for this week's Medical Halacha Chabura. Just to quickly review, we've already developed the idea and the principle that murder is aser. And we discussed a couple of reasons why. We know that you can't murder one person to save your own life or to save someone else's life, either because murder is so terrible, chumras haveira, it's so chamor, or because you can't play God. You don't know whose life is more valuable, or it's not that we can't figure out whose life is more valuable, it's that everyone's life is inherently and by definition of equal value. So our question now is, what if it's no longer one versus one? We've already established that you cannot sacrifice one life for another life, but what about sacrificing one life to save the many? So last week, we laid down the foundation and discussed all of the various case studies and categories, but now we're going to really get into the nitty-gritty. So once again, we discussed that you cannot sacrifice one person to save another. So now let's discuss this question. Do these same principles apply to cases with different variables? So can you sacrifice one person to save, let's say, 100 people? Can you say that the same principles we already said apply here, or would it perhaps be mutter now? So we're going to basically analyze this using the same exact template that we've established already. And for the sake of contrast, though, before we really get into all the different halachic sources, let's just establish the utilitarian perspective first, because the halachic perspective will really come in contrast to the classic utilitarianist consequentialist perspective. So Jeremy Bentham, I don't know how many of you have ever heard of Jeremy Bentham. He actually is sitting in a university in Europe right now. His body has been preserved. He didn't want to be buried. So he was a leading utilitarian thinker. And he advanced the view that moral decisions should always be made based on the outcome. That's the basic utilitarian consequentialist perspective. It's that what is moral, what is right, what is good is always based on the outcome. Whatever course of action will produce the most human happiness or the greatest benefit to the greatest number of people, that is the morally correct route to take. So let's say you have a choice of one life or five. So the obvious choice, according to utilitarianism, is to choose the five. It doesn't matter how you would do that. It doesn't matter the course of action you would take. It's all about the results. So whether it means pulling the lever on the trolley, or programming a self-driving car, or any other case, you'd always choose the fewer fatalities, you choose the numbers. It would be the quantity. So your priority would be saving the most lives. And it makes sense, at least at first. Like, for example, if you're a Hatzalah member, you'd want to save more lives. So, but here's where it gets a little interesting, because first of all, not only would you be permitted to sacrifice the few, save the many, according to this, you'd be obligated to do so. This would be what is morally correct. So what's the problem with this? You'll see how it gets a little problematic, because halacha doesn't work that way. And most ethical systems don't work that way. So halacha doesn't only take the result, the after effects of an action into account. According to halacha, you also focus on other variables, such as the act itself, such as the intent, such as all the different variables in place. So if you're learning classical moral philosophy, you usually contrast utilitarianism with deontology or Kantian ethics, deontological ethics. So what is Kantian deontological ethics? So that perspective of ethical theory, moral theory, is that the morality of an act is solely based on the nature of the act itself. So as opposed to utilitarianism, which is all about the result, deontology is all about the nature of the act. So murder, according to deontology, is always immoral, no matter what, because the act of murder is immoral, and therefore murder is always immoral. I mean, it's really interesting. I don't know how many of you guys are aware of all of these different theories and the problems with these theories, but one of the most famous problems with this approach is the lack of nuance and the lack of room for exceptions. Kant, he was a very famous philosopher. He really revolutionized Western philosophy, because Western philosophy basically had this premise that if you use philosophy and you keep on philosophizing, eventually you will come to the ultimate truth. And Kant basically claimed that it's not true, because you'll only come to the truth that you can come to based on your human faculties of knowledge, but you will never attain objective truth. You'll only gain the truth from a human perspective, which is basically what Kabbalah has been teaching, far, far, far before Kant ever wrote any of his theories. But he basically revolutionized the Western understanding of philosophy, being that they weren't exposed to Kabbalah yet. But he had a lot of other theories, such as this ethical theory. And this deontological theory basically didn't have room for exception. So people came over to him and they asked him, so what would you do if a robber came knocking on your door and said that I am here to kill, so-and-so, and that so-and-so happens to be, you're opening the door, and it happens to be your mother or your friend or your brother or your father. And the robber, the killer, whatever it is, says, is this person inside your house? So Kant famously said that you would have to tell the killer and the robber, you'd have to tell them the truth. You'd say, yes, the person's upstairs hiding underneath the bed. And the reason you have to do that is because lying is an immoral act. So people went berserk and they said, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You're going to have to tell the truth to this murderer because it's inappropriate to lie? Like, that doesn't make any sense. It's a hack. So he was famous for not having any wiggle room, for not having room for exceptions, and that was where he got a lot of people really critiqued him. So it's also just interesting to note that where does halacha fall into this? Do we just, I don't know how many of you guys are aware of the different moral theories. So you have utilitarianism, which consequentialism is a form of that, which is all based on the result, all based on the consequence, based on the outcome. You have deontology, which is that it's all based on the act itself. Then you have virtue ethics, which is basically Aristotelian ethics, that morality is not based off of the act or the result, but based off of, without getting into, you have to really need a whole lecture to develop this, but it'll be based on what is virtuous, meaning what is moral, is based on what a virtuous person would do. So it's not about a specific type of act, and it's not a specific type of result. It's more of a holistic perspective of morality, is you should do that which virtuous people do. And the way to understand what virtuous people do is to study and surround yourself with and expose yourself to virtuous people, and then to habitualize virtuous acts. The classic problem with Aristotelian that virtue theory is that it's so abstract and unquantifiable. Because how do you know who's virtuous? The way you know who's virtuous is by looking around and just knowing who's virtuous. That's basically what he would say. But that's very abstract, because there's no way to quantify it, to give, like, this is what's virtuous, this is what's not virtuous. It's more like, look around you, the people around you who are virtuous, ask them how to live life, and that's what morality is about. So it's hard to really pinpoint what a virtuous act would be, because who says that this person's a virtuous person? Who's there to qualify or to give you, actual definitions? It becomes very complicated, and it's an endless, you keep on going in circles. There's a lot of other theories when it comes to morality, but those are, good introduction, those three. So where's halacha come in? So halacha is a little more nuanced than that. It's definitely similar to virtue ethics in the sense that it's more abstract, but it is, you take into account a lot of different aspects. So when it comes to halacha, when it comes to lamdas, when it comes to analyzing these types of questions, you take into account the act. You take into account the result. You can't take into account the intention. That gets into a lot of, for example, you have hasra when it comes to convicting a felon. So let's say a person's about to murder someone. You have to give them hasra. Some of the opinions on why you need hasra, you need to warn them, the witnesses, the edim need to warn the assailant, is in order to make sure that the assailant has proper kavana, has intent to do this, and doesn't think that this is munter, or not realize what the punishment is, or etc. So you have to have one opinion is to make it a real rebellious or really horrible act. The only way it's a horrible act is if I tell you don't do this, and you say, no, I'm doing it anyways. So one is intention, one is the type of action, one is, for example, the result. Let's say a person has intention to kill someone. A person swings down his sword or shoots the bullet, but misses. So it was a bad act. The guy had bad intentions, but there was just no bad result. So we don't go based on isolating one factor and saying this is the be-all, end-all, this is what morality is. It's more of a all the different factors involved. And that's why the Ramban famously says that, and you can actually look at this Ramban if you go to Dvarim, Sefer Dvarim, and I think it's in Perek Vav, Pasuk Yitches, where he says that you're not really able, the Torah isn't able to give you an all-encompassing system, which is basically this is how you should do every single thing, this is how you should act in every single case, because the morality is more giving you the Torah can give you the basic principles, but because life is so complicated and because every single case scenario has different factors, which are the nature of the act, nature of the result, nature of the intent, the nature of all these different factors involved, it's not like it's always about the results or always about the act or always about the intent or always about one thing. It's more of this kind of holistic perspective and all of the principles interconnecting. So this is one of the ideas behind the concept in some many Jewish circles of Das Torah. It's that there's no real way of this is the approach and this is what's going to be the answer. It's more once you become Torah, which is very related to the concept of virtue ethics and virtue theory. It's that once you become Torah, you basically have the tools to assess and analyze each situation and understand what to do. And I just want to really build the introduction to that topic. Because now getting back to the utilitarian perspective. So what's the problem with the utilitarian perspective? Because according to utilitarianism, you should be able to sacrifice and kill the one to save the many. So we actually discussed this case before, but let's say there's a doctor, and he's entrusted with 5 critically ill patients, and each patient suffers from a serious illness, and he's in dire need of a life-saving organ. So let's say you have 5 patients, and one needs a heart, and two of them need a kidney, and one needs a pair of lungs, and one needs a liver, and there's no prospect, there's no donor in sight, and these patients have no chance of survival. But the doctor then strolls into the waiting area and he passes a healthy gentleman who has a fresh set of lungs, a beating heart, 2 working kidneys, an active liver. So technically speaking, this doctor could take this man's organs and restore health and save 5 patients. So according to the utilitarian approach, it would appear that this doctor should sacrifice the one, sacrifice the individual, and save the many. Now, nobody would consider this a plausible course of action. So a person's visceral reaction to this suggestion would be horror and revulsion. It's impossible to justify the outright murder of an innocent person, even if you have the numbers. So furthermore, beyond just the philosophical realm, living in that world where if you go to the doctor's office, you're afraid of being killed, it would be horrifying, it would be terrifying, that society would not function. And yes, you could say that, okay, that's true, so utilitarianism would have to qualify itself, would have to say that in general we want to do what's best. Either you'd say that in general we do this, but there are exceptions, or you'd say that, okay, sure, and true that in such a case you'd be saving 5 people, but it would not result in the ultimate happiness because of what you're saying. But I don't want to get into the technicalities and the complications and the qualifications. I just want to kind of introduce that to now contrast it with the Jewish approach. Because when it comes to the Jewish approach, we're not just dealing with the results. We're dealing with halachic reality. We're dealing with the importance of the nature of action, the nature of isur, the nature of the importance of life, and all these other values. So what we've been building up to until now is really this question, which is how do we approach the topic of sacrificing the few to save the many? Because we already developed 2 approaches to understand why you're not allowed to kill one to save another. Now, the question is, can these same two approaches of chumras havira and your inability to play God, meaning either you're not allowed to murder because it's so bad, or you're not allowed to murder because you're not allowed to choose whose life is more valuable, you're not allowed to choose one life over another, can we apply this in the same way to sacrificing one life to save the many? Or is there a difference? So the first option that we're going to suggest is that there is no difference, that it's prohibited, it's usur, to sacrifice the few to save the many, just like it's prohibited, it's usur, to sacrifice one to save one. So why would that be? Either, remember, the first approach is that murder is such an egregious action that it's preferable to give up your life rather than live as a murderer. So the assumption is that the chai behem, which is the ability to violate a mitzvah to save your life, it doesn't apply to murder. And if that were the case, then in a situation where you can save many lives and sacrifice many lives to save one person, then it would still be prohibited because it's not about numbers. It's about this is a horrible act no matter what. No matter what the results are, no matter what the value is, you are not allowed to murder. It is never allowed. That's one option when it comes to chumras havira. The second approach we suggested is that you are unable to measure the worth of one life versus another life because either, once again, why was this? Why can't you determine whose life is better? Why can't you say his blood's better? Because this is not about the chai behem. It's not about your ability to murder or not to murder, because we don't care about the affair. Either the affair gets knocked out, just like chai behem works in the effect of knocking it out, and even if it doesn't knock it out, meaning that's not the problem. The problem isn't about the avir element. It's about you playing God. It's about you saying, I'm choosing this person's life over this person's life. And you could say that it doesn't matter how many lives are being saved. You can say that for whatever reason, remember we posited four, we can go over them. We posited four options as to why it's impossible to determine relative human worth. And we can apply all of them here to say that despite the fact that more lives are being saved, you still can't play God. You still cannot choose to save these lives at the expense of other people's lives. So one option we gave, the first option, is that the determinant factor of worth is a person's time left in this world. So you can say that even in the case of a mass of people where you're saving so many people, this kind of worth still can't be determined. Meaning, perhaps the individual who you're trying to sacrifice will live for, let's say, 10 years, and this larger group of people will all die within minutes or within hours or within a year. If you add all of their time left in this world, it will be under 10 years. You just don't know. We don't know who will live for longer, and therefore, even if it's the many versus the one, this cheshbon, this calculation of the value of time, is still in place. Or you can say the same thing for mitzvah observance. If, like, remember, both of these were by the Yad Ramah, who said that the calculation is about either the amount of time you have left in this world or the amount of mitzvah performance you have left, you can say the same thing. Let's say you have one person versus five, and this one person will do, you can just say X amount of mitzvahs. So let's say, we'll just give a random number, 1,000, and hopefully much more. We'll just make it an even 1,000. And all these five people left, either because they're going to die soon or because of whatever, will only do less than 1,000 mitzvahs, 999 or under. So we don't know. Or you can even say they'll both do 1,000. It doesn't really matter. We don't know. Now, the third option we gave was that it's about we don't know who will become... the third option was current status. We don't know who's a bigger tzaddik. So remember, the reason we don't know who's a bigger tzaddik is because we don't know the level each person was on, where they were born into, what their purpose was, how much of their potential they've actualized, what their actual spiritual status is. You can say the same thing that you cannot calculate spiritual status, and therefore, regardless of how many people, you still cannot make that calculation. And the last option is really the easiest, because the last option is that each person is of infinite value. And therefore, meaning either, we actually did two, we said either each person is of infinite value, all built b'sal malikim, all have infinite value, all have equal value, because if you have each person of infinite value, infinity equals infinity, and therefore you're of equal value. And we also said the same principle when it comes to time, that all of time, we're not going to go into that, it's a little more complicated. But you could argue that since everyone is of equal value, it doesn't matter how many people. Like, infinity equals infinity. And you can say infinity plus infinity plus infinity plus infinity plus infinity, that would be five people, is equal to infinity, which is one person. Therefore, you cannot sacrifice one to save the many. That would be the basic logic behind that first approach, which is that it's just like you're not allowed to kill one to save one, you're not allowed to kill one to save five. There is, however, an entire other perspective, which is that it is permitted to sacrifice the few to save the many. So what's the logic behind that? The logic would be like this. It's possible that only in a case where it's one person versus one person, then we say that you cannot violate this issue of murder. But perhaps in order to save the lives of many, like once we're dealing with, let's say, so we have to decide what is many, but let's say 100 people, we can argue even five, but let's say just for simplicity, 100 people, then even the horrific sin of murder, of ritzicha, would be allowed. Meaning, and it doesn't have to clash with the Gemara. The Gemara is talking about one versus one. When it comes to one versus one, ma'ichazes, you can't do it, it's terrible avir, etc. But when it comes to one to 100, you could say maybe we allow this terrible issur. It's a shasat chak, it's an exception. The rules change. You have to have within your system, every system has to have rules and has to have where are the exceptions. Now, sometimes you can say there are no exceptions. Sometimes there are rare exceptions. Now, maybe this is one of the rare exceptions. Another possibility is that you're not allowed to, we said the reason why you're not allowed to kill one to save one is because you're not allowed to play God. Who says, how do you know whose life is more valuable? But perhaps these ideas, these options, apply only to the case of trading one for one. In that case, you can't play God. You can't choose who's going to live, who's going to die. You don't know, etc., etc. But maybe in the case of sacrificing one to save the many, it would be different. Why? Well, let's go through each one. We said the first option was that we don't know who's going to live longer, who has more time left. Well, perhaps, what's the svara that we don't know who has more time left? You can't go on rove, you can't go on chazaka, you can't assume that any one person will live longer than any one person. But perhaps that's only when we're dealing with one versus one, that the assumption is that you don't know. But maybe when it's one versus five, one versus 100, then the assumption is that these people's collective time in this world will be longer than one person's time in this world. And you can say the same thing for mitzvah performance, mitzvah observance. And maybe it's true that when it comes to one versus one, we don't know who's going to do more mitzvahs, but when it comes to one versus five, one versus 100, maybe we could assume that the sum of mitzvah of a larger group will assumably be more than just one person. And you can say same thing for level of righteousness, that maybe when it comes to one versus one, we don't know who's a bigger tzaddik. When it comes to one versus the many, we assume that there's a higher level of spirituality, of tzidkus, of whatever you want to say is the actual term. You could assume that it'll be some higher status of the collective, of the masses, of the many, than just one. And you can even say possibly that when it comes to equal value, that's only every one person is equal to every one person. Then you can say that that's fine. But if you could possibly see that even though every person is of infinite value, and it's a mathematical truth that some infinities are of a greater degree than others, it's cardinalities, right? That perhaps the infinite worth of 100 people's lives is greater than the infinite worth of just one person's life. You could argue that. You could say no. You could say yes. There's definitely room to say both. Now, it's also just interesting to note that, nonetheless, once the potential of sacrificing one life for the sake of the many is considered, once we are considering this, you have to determine the boundaries and definition of the many, which is we've been playing with this. Because how much is the many? In the trolley case, it's one versus five. So what is one versus the many? Is it one versus 100, one versus five, one versus all of Klal Yisrael, when we get in the discussion of Esther and why Esther was different? She was allowed to theoretically violate Gilui Raos, according to some opinions, to save Klal Yisrael. So some people argue that the only reason why such an egregious sin was allowed was because it was to save all of Klal Yisrael. So Is it just about saving the many, or do you have to literally be saving all of Klal Yisrael to be able to violate such a bad thing, one of the big three? So you can really ask, is sacrificing one to save the many only allowed if it's a group of 100? What about 99? Or 50, or 25, or 500, or 10, or 2? Or like, what is enough? Is it, as long as we get past one, like you need to have more than one, you have to have like more than, let's say, a minion, you have to have more than 10, 10, more than 10, less than 10, you have to have more than 100. Like, where are we deciding this number? And if any of you are familiar with classical philosophical paradoxes, such as the famous heap paradox, and the heap paradox basically goes like this. You have a heap of sand. A heap of sand is referred to as a heap of sand. It's a bunch of grains of sand. Now, what if you have this heap of sand, and from this heap of sand, you start removing grains individually? So it's assumed that you have a heap of sand and you remove a single grain of sand. Is it still a heap of sand? Yeah, so it's not a non-heap anymore. It's still a heap of sand. You just took out a piece of grain. But what if you do this again and again and again and again? Eventually, the heap will, in fact, lose its status as a heap. So the question becomes, when? Like, at what point did this heap of sand switch from being a heap to a non-heap? Is there a single grain of sand that changed its status? And there are so many of these questions. For example, it's the same bald paradox. A person is not bald, he has hair, and then at a certain point he's referred to as bald, where he still will have some hair, but there will be a bald patch. At what point does a man go from being bald, from being not bald to being bald? At what point does that transition occur? Which hair creates that transition? Or the classic ship paradox. This is more identity paradox, where you have a ship, and you replace one piece of that ship. And every day you replace another piece of that ship until every single piece of that ship has been replaced over the course of, let's say, a year or 2 years. Is this ship the same ship as it was a year ago? Because remember, every single piece on the ship, every single one is different than it was a year ago. Is this the same ship? If it is not the same ship, at what point did it become a different ship? Think about your body. At a certain point in your life, every single cell in your body is regrown. I mean, your cells are dying all the time, and your cells are regrowing, and that's why you're still here, at a faster rate. And death basically occurs when the death rate of your cells is going faster than the creation rate. So I don't know the exact percentage, but you can literally say that there's very few, if any, of the same cells in your body as there were a long time ago for you. And are you the same being as you were back then? And if the answer is yes, why? So the spiritual approach is that you're a soul, you're not a body. But if you are a biologist and you are you're reducing humanity to biological factors, what determines continuity of the human being the fact that there is so little of you that's still there that was before? And it's a difficult question. They'll have to go to some element of continued consciousness, continued memories, etc. But, I mean, if you believe in the soul, it's very easy. As long as you have the same soul as you did beforehand, it doesn't matter if the body is becoming different along the way. But we're dealing with a very similar question here, which is that even if you're allowed to sacrifice the few to save the many, what is considered the many? At what point do we draw the line and say, no, that's no longer the many that we're talking about here? And it's really hard. Like, I cannot give you a definitive answer here. It requires more thought. But the point is that it is possible that one may never sacrifice the life of a single individual, even to save the lives of 100. And, like, this basically says that even though there's svara to say it might be mutter, there is definitely a possibility that it will not be mutter, and most Jewish thinkers think that you are not allowed to. We're going to have to think about whether or not it might be mutter, but like the assumption would be that it would be very hard to say that it is mutter. So now we want to transition from the abstract of just sacrificing the few to save the many to the trolley problem. Can you pull the lever? Right? We just, with the above considerations in mind, meaning that we've discussed the basic framework and paradigm for the sugya. So now going to the trolley problem, are you allowed to pull the lever and turn the trolley towards that single worker on the side? So we previously established that there are two potential reasons why you would not be able to, either because of chumras avira, or because you are not allowed to play God. And the question becomes, do these same variables apply by the trolley case? So next year, we will delve right into the trolley problem and all of the halachic applications. I hope you have an incredible week, everyone, and I cannot wait until next week's share.